readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and sadly, summer seems to be winding down. Soon it will be back to school and back to a full workload at the office. So, as your literary guide, I'm offering up a show that gets down to business, but with titles that are newsmakers for a reason. They are timely and entertaining, informative and innovative. I know you'll find some titles to add to your reading list. That's our agenda. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, ranked 8th on Fortune's list of the 50 most powerful women in business. In her popular book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead, she urges women to take risks and seek new challenges, to find work they love, and to remain passionately engaged with it throughout their lives. The book grew out of an electrifying TED Talk Sandberg gave in 2010, in which she expressed her concern that progress for women in achieving major leadership positions had stalled. The talk became a phenomenon. In Lean In, she fuses personal anecdotes, lessons on confidence and leadership, and practical advice for women based on research and on lessons learned by other successful women. Sandberg has an uncanny gift for cutting through layers of ambiguity that surround working women. That's why the book report is sure you'll enjoy this title. Narrated by Alyssa Donovan.
I got pregnant with my first child in the summer of 2004. At the time, I was running the online sales and operations groups at Google. I had joined the company 3.5 years earlier when it was an obscure startup with a few hundred employees in a rundown office building. By my first trimester, Google had grown into a company of thousands and moved into a multi-building campus. My pregnancy was not easy. The typical morning sickness that often accompanies the first trimester affected me every day for 9 long months. I gained almost 70 pounds, and my feet swelled 2 entire shoe sizes, turning into odd-shaped lumps I could see only when they were propped up on a coffee table. A particularly sensitive Google engineer announced that Project Whale was named after me. One day, after a rough morning spent staring at the bottom of the toilet, I had to rush to make an important client meeting. Google was growing so quickly that parking was an ongoing problem, and the only spot I could find was quite far away. I sprinted across the parking lot, which in reality meant lumbering a bit more quickly than my absurdly slow pregnancy crawl. This only made my nausea worse. And I arrived at the meeting praying that a sales pitch was the only thing that would come out of my mouth. That night, I recounted these troubles to my husband, Dave. He pointed out that Yahoo, where he worked at the time, had designated parking for expectant mothers at the front of each building. The next day, I marched in, or more like waddled in, to see Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin in their office, which was really just a large room with toys and gadgets strewn all over the floor. I found Sergey in a yoga position in the corner and announced that we needed pregnancy parking, preferably sooner rather than later. He looked up at me and agreed immediately, noting that he had never thought about it before. To this day, I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize that pregnant women needed reserved parking until I experienced my own aching feet. As one of Google's most senior women, didn't I have a special responsibility to think of this? But like Sergey, it had never occurred to me. The other pregnant women must have suffered in silence, not wanting to ask for special treatment. Or maybe they lacked the confidence or seniority to demand that the problem be fixed. Having one pregnant woman at the top, even one who looked like a whale, made the difference. Today in the United States and the developed world, women are better off than ever. We stand on the shoulders of the women who came before us, women who had to fight for the rights that we now take for granted. In 1947, Anita Summers, the mother of my longtime mentor Larry Summers, was hired as an economist by the Standard Oil Company. When she accepted the job, her new boss said to her, "I am so glad to have you. I figure I am getting the same brains for less money." Her reaction to this was to feel flattered. It was a huge compliment to be told that she had the same brains as a man. It would have been unthinkable for her to ask for equal compensation. We feel even more grateful when we compare our lives to those of other women around the world. There are still countries that deny women basic civil rights. Worldwide, about 4.4 million women and girls are trapped in the sex trade. In places like Afghanistan and Sudan, girls receive little or no education. Wives are treated as the property of their husbands, and women who are raped are routinely cast out of their homes for disgracing their families. Some rape victims are even sent to jail for committing a moral crime. We are centuries ahead of the unacceptable treatment of women in these countries. But knowing that things could be worse should not stop us from trying to make them better. When the suffragettes marched in the streets, they envisioned a world where men and women would be truly equal. A century later, we are still squinting, trying to bring that vision into focus. The blunt truth is that men still run the world. Of the 195 independent countries in the world, only 17 are led by women.
That was Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. For generations, we've focused on the individual drivers of success: passion, hard work, talent, and luck. But today, success is increasingly dependent on how we interact with others. It turns out that at work, most people operate as either takers, matchers, or givers. Takers strive to get as much as possible from others. Matchers aim to trade evenly. And givers are the rare breed who contribute to others without expecting anything in return. Using his own pioneering research as Wharton's youngest tenured professor, Adam Grant in Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, shows that although some givers get exploited and burn out, the rest achieve extraordinary results. Give and Take, narrated by Brian Keith Davis, highlights what effective networking, collaboration, influence, negotiation, and leadership skills have in common.
Although Hornick hoped Shader would conclude that the right decision was to sign with him, he put Shader's best interests ahead of his own, giving Shader space to explore other options. Shader did just that. He spent the next few weeks pitching his idea to other investors. In the meantime, Hornick wanted to make sure he was still a strong contender, so he sent Shader his most valuable resource, a list of 40 references who could attest to Hornick's caliber as an investor. Hornick knew that entrepreneurs look for the same attributes in investors that we all seek in financial advisors: competence and trustworthiness. When entrepreneurs sign with an investor, the investor joins their board of directors and provides expert advice. Hornick's list of references reflected the blood, sweat, and tears that he had devoted to entrepreneurs over the course of more than a decade in the venture business. He knew they would vouch for his skill and his character. A few weeks later, Hornick's phone rang. It was Shader, ready to announce his decision. "I'm sorry," Shader said, "but I'm signing with another investor." The financial terms of the offer from Hornick and the other investor were virtually identical. So Hornick's list of 40 references should have given him an advantage. And after speaking with the references, it was clear to Shader that Hornick was a great guy. But it was this very same spirit of generosity that doomed Hornick's case. Shader worried that Hornick would spend more time encouraging him than challenging him. Hornick might not be tough enough to help Shader start a successful business. And the other investor had a reputation for being a brilliant advisor who questioned and pushed entrepreneurs. Shader walked away thinking, I should probably add somebody to the board who will challenge me more. Hornick is so affable that I don't know what he'll be like in the boardroom. When he called Hornick, he explained, "My heart said to go with you, but my head said to go with them. I decided to go with my head instead of my heart." Hornick was devastated, and he began to second-guess himself. Am I a dope? If I had applied pressure to take the term sheet, maybe he would have taken it. But I've spent a decade building my reputation so this wouldn't happen. How did this happen? David Hornick learned his lesson the hard way. Good guys finish last. Or do they? According to conventional wisdom, highly successful people have three things in common: motivation, ability, and opportunity. If we want to succeed, we need a combination of hard work, talent, and luck. The story of Danny Shader and David Hornick highlights a fourth ingredient, one that's critical but often neglected. Success depends heavily on how we approach our interactions with other people. Every time we interact with another person at work, we have a choice to make. Do we try to claim as much value as we can, or contribute value without worrying about what we receive in return? As an organizational psychologist and Wharton professor, I've dedicated more than 10 years of my professional life to studying these choices at organizations ranging from Google to the U.S. Air Force. And it turns out that they have staggering consequences for success. Over the past three decades, in a series of groundbreaking studies, social scientists have discovered that people differ dramatically in their preferences for reciprocity, their desired mix of taking and giving. To shed some light on these preferences, let me introduce you to two kinds of people who fall at opposite ends of the reciprocity spectrum at work. I call them takers and givers. Takers have a distinctive signature. They like to get more than they give. They tilt reciprocity in their own favor, putting their own interests ahead of others' needs.
We've just heard Give and Take by Adam Grant. In Breaking Out, How to Build Influence in a World of Competing Ideas, John Buttman shows how the methods of today's idea entrepreneurs, including dog psychologist Cesar Millan and Tom's founder Blake McCoskey and many others, can help you take an idea public and build influence for it. Buttman argues that the rise of the ideaplex, like TED, Twitter, NPR, YouTube, online learning, and all the rest, has caused an explosion in the creation and sharing of ideas. It seems to be easier to go public, yet much harder to gain influence. If you have an idea and want to make a difference in your organization, build a change movement in your community, or improve the world, this book, narrated by Eric Sinisvet, could start you on the journey to idea entrepreneurship.
It's difficult to develop an idea and harder to express it well. It's tough to get people simply to hear your idea and harder still to enable them to understand it in ways that come close to your intended meaning. To cause others to incorporate your idea into their thinking stream? Challenging. To change their behavior, even in small ways? Daunting. To make a difference, start a movement, change the world? Hard, harder, hardest. And yet, people accomplish all these things, to a greater or lesser degree, and with smaller or larger numbers of people, more often and more successfully than you might think. My purpose: how the idea entrepreneur goes public, breaks out, and achieves influence, and how you can too, is the subject of this book. I am not so much concerned with how to generate ideas, because that is typically not the idea entrepreneur's problem. They usually have an idea, or the makings of one, but are uncertain how to express, go public, and gain influence with it. Besides, there is plenty of good content available elsewhere on the topics of creativity, idea generation, and innovation. Nor do I go very deeply into the tactical aspects of breaking out, such as how to put together a sequenced program of activities. When do I start tweeting? How much content should I give away? or technical questions, such as the advantages and disadvantages of self-publishing. That's because there is no template. All these matters change rapidly, and every case is different. It would be better for you to talk with experts on this, or to catch up with the current thinking available in content venues that, unlike books, do not take a year or two, or more, to create. Finally, I don't go deeply into the financial aspects of idea entrepreneurship in this book. That is, how to monetize an idea, or create profit from it. That's primarily because making money is not the main goal of the idea entrepreneur. They want to gain influence, change thinking, affect behavior. And they can do these things without earning much, if any, money. However, many idea entrepreneurs make lots of money, into the millions, even if they do not earn on the scale of business tycoons and superstar entertainers. What do I talk about? The essential elements that go into forming an idea. What is needed to take an idea public? How ideas and idea entrepreneurs fare in the Ideaplex? How and why ideas break out from others? How they influence thinking and affect behavior? How ideas and their creators fit into larger societal thinking streams? Genesis. Before I get into all of those things, however, let me say that not everyone with an idea wants to or should break out, which is just as well given that we have an idea glut. And I offer my father as an example. Dad was an electrical engineer who spent his career at Lincoln Laboratory, an MIT research and development center not far from Boston. Inside and outside the lab, Dad was constantly coming up with ideas for how the world could be improved in one way or another. In the 1960s, Dad became fascinated with solar power and the need for renewable energy sources. To express his fascination and put it into practice, he built a rudimentary sun-powered water heater, a rectangular box, perhaps 3 feet wide by 8 feet long, painted black on the inside, through which he ran several switchbacks of copper water pipe and mounted it on the roof of our summer cottage, then hooked it up to the outdoor shower. On a sunny day, it warmed enough water for a pretty good wetting. The solar heater got people talking, but I didn't notice anyone else putting one on their roof, at least not then. Dad continued to be fascinated by renewable energy issues throughout his life. When he was in his 80s, he would regularly join my wife, Nancy, and me for Sunday dinner. And more often than not, he had a new idea he wanted to run by us. One of them involved a plan for replacing conventional light bulbs with strobe lights, which he argued would save huge amounts of energy, and thanks to the persistence of human vision, would not affect the quality of illumination we experienced. He seemed so taken by the idea that I asked if he wanted to develop it further, or perhaps write about it. "No," he said with a sigh and a smile. "I just like talking about it."
That was Breaking Out by John Buttman. Ben Mezrich has created his own highly addictive genre of nonfiction, chronicling the stories of young geniuses making tons of money on the steep edge of ethics and morality. Mezrich has authored 13 books, including Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions, which spent 63 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and was the basis for the movie 21 with Kevin Spacey. And of course, his book, The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, was adapted into the hit film, The Social Network. And Mezrich does the research, non-traditionally at times. During his research for Bringing Down the House, he taped $250,000 to his body and smuggled it through airport security with some notorious card counters, thus getting an insider look at the Vegas high-rolling lifestyle. Now, in Straight Flush, Mezrich writes the true tale of a group of American college buddies who built a billion-dollar online poker colossus. Based on extensive insider interviews and participation, Straight Flush chronicles the rags-to-riches story of a group of University of Montana frat brothers who turned a weekly poker game in the basement of a local dive bar into AbsolutePoker.com, one of the largest online companies in the world. At its height, Absolute Poker earned more than $1 million a day.
Its founders set up operations in Costa Rica and embraced an outrageous lifestyle of girls, parties, and money. But the U.S. Justice Department placed a bullseye on the company. The result is one of the wildest business stories of the past decade. Welcome, Ben. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
How did you get intrigued by Absolute Poker's story?
I got emails from some of the founders. Ever since Bringing Down the House and then after The Social Network, I've become kind of the go-to guy for every college kid who does something crazy. And I got emails from the guys. One of them was a fugitive in Antigua, couldn't set foot off the island. The other one was about to go to jail. And the whole thing intrigued me, how these kids basically launched the online poker world.
So they contacted you?
Yeah, and wow. That's pretty much how all my books have come. I basically just sit at home and wait for people to contact me.
Okay, you got that world call, Ben. All right. Well, tell us a little about each of the company's founders.
Sure. I mean, it's a group of fraternity guys from the University of Montana. They were all frat brothers, and they used to play poker in the basement of a local bar. I mean, these were poor kids. Most of them were from hard backgrounds. One of them had sold a cow to buy his first car. So they didn't really come from money. And they play poker, and they basically realized that, you know, if they could get it online and make this into sort of an internet company, a lot of money could be made. So this was kind of the dawn of the internet and internet commerce. And there was only one other poker site at the time, something called Paradise Poker, and it was very rudimentary. So they basically had this idea to do it, and so they moved their fraternity to Costa Rica. And so it ended up being a very wild place to be because it was pretty much lawless. But that's where they launched their company and built it from there.
What year was that, actually?
Well, they got the idea around 1999, and then around 2002 is when they ended up in Costa Rica.
All right. Can you tell us a little about each of the guys?
Yeah. I mean, the main guy, his name is Scott Tom, and he was, kind of a complex character, like I said, the way to describe it. He grew up in a very hard situation, kind of in a trailer. His mother was into drugs and things like that, and he ended up at the University of Montana and sort of rebuilding himself there. There was Garen, his buddy, who was kind of the jock of the group. Brent, his younger stepbrother or half-brother, who was kind of the naive kid, who ended up, you know, following Scott out to Costa Rica. And Pete Barovich, who was the president of the fraternity and more of sort of the marketing genius behind it. And there was Shane, who was a cool guy who ended up having a lot of problems with drugs and ended up having to go to rehab in the middle of the story. But those are kind of the main characters, I would say. And then Hilt. And Hilt was a rich kid from a rich family in Florida who brought in a lot of the money for them in the beginning.
How many of these guys did you actually interview for the book?
All of them. Huh. So everybody involved in the book was part of the research process.
How long did you research the story?
I would say 6 or 7 months. I had to go to Antigua a lot. One of the characters would meet me in Toronto because it was the closest to the United States he was willing to go. The kid, Brent, who ended up going to jail, he's in prison right now. I was able to get to him before he went into prison. So I would say 6 or 7 months altogether of research.
You know, when I read the book, I'm not sure I liked these guys very much. But when you met them and spoke with them, were they likable?
Well, I mean, they're complex. You know, they're not the geeks I wrote about for Bringing Down the House. You know, they're not these MIT geniuses, and they're not even sort of the Facebook type guys. These guys were kind of hard partying jocks, you know, who in Costa Rica, it was a very wild place for them. There was a lot of craziness. So whether they're likable or not, I mean, people are going to have different opinions on them. A lot of people hate Scott Tom. I mean, he's raised a lot of anger in the poker community over the years. I got along with them, but, you know, I get along with everybody. So it's hard for me to judge people that way.
All right. Okay, well, talk about the Unlawful Internet Gambling and Enforcement Act.
Sure. So when these guys started the company, whether or not online poker is legal or not was something no one could really answer. You know, if you ask 10 lawyers, 5 would give one answer and 5 would give another. In 2006, two senators passed a bill by attaching it to a port terrorism bill. So it was basically snuck through. And it basically made online poker much more gray area and in some states illegal. And the bill basically said that the movement of money from a player to a company involved in something that was illegal gambling would be money laundering and fraud. So it essentially made the movement of money into a poker company illegal if any state in the country had laws on the books that made that company's business illegal. So online poker became illegal in a bunch of states with that bill. And most poker companies fled the business then. They just fled the American market and just stayed in Europe. These guys, after the poker, stayed in the American market, and they basically were now in a dangerous place.
Yeah. You know, as you say in the book, if betting in Vegas is legal, if buying a lottery ticket is fine, why is online poker illegal?
Well, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's very, it's hypocrisy. The idea that we all lined up for Powerball tickets a few weeks ago, and yet online poker is illegal, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, poker is a game of skill more than it's a game of chance. Most people agree with that. It doesn't really make any sense. It's just that it was the only thing they could go after at the time. The other thing is that the government wasn't getting money from it because it wasn't regulated, it wasn't taxed. And I think that will change. I think online poker will now become illegal over the next few years, and the government will get its piece of it. But there really is no reason to that law. If it were a regulated industry, it wouldn't be this shady thing where people would be losing their money. There wouldn't be all this cheating. I think it would be a much better situation. But, you know, that's for the future, I guess.
Well, your story begins with one of the group, Brent Beckley. And do you think he took the fall for the other guys?
He absolutely did so far. I mean, he turned himself in. He was, you know, he's a nice kid. He's a naive guy. His name was on everything because he was running sort of the banking side of it. He was running the account, so his name was on all the payment processors. So he was definitely going to get in trouble. When he turned himself in, he did it because he had two young kids. He wanted them to come to America. He wanted to get out of Costa Rica. And he thought he wasn't going to get any jail time, but the judge threw the book at him and gave him 14 months in a federal prison. So he really did take the fall, although Scott is still in Antigua, refuses to give himself up. So he is facing a very large indictment. So, you know, eventually, if he doesn't make some sort of a deal, he will end up in jail as well.
So what about the other guys? Where are they now?
They're kind of spread out. You know, a couple of them won't come to the United States because they're afraid of getting arrested or subpoenaed. Two of them actually now have moved back to the U.S. and haven't had any trouble yet. It's very tricky. You know, nobody really understands the law. I don't think even the Department of Justice's own lawyers really understand what's going on with online poker and online gaming. So it's still, you know, an interesting and developing story.
You know, these guys were millionaires. It's hard to kind of understand why they didn't lawyer up with the best of the best and beat these charges.
Well, they did. I mean, they spent millions on lawyers. But eventually, you know, it became a standoff. The state of New York and the Department of Justice were making deals, but they wanted huge amounts of money. Poker Stars paid a $751 million fine. The Absolute Poker guys don't have that kind of money. So they were unable to make a deal. So it's basically, you know, a situation where their lawyers are attempting to negotiate a way for Scott to sort of give himself up and not do jail time. But with Brent, it ended up not working out. He ended up in jail.
So when Brent gets out of jail, is he going to be broke or is he going to be pretty sad?
Well, he said he's broke. He had to pay $1 million fine. He didn't have the lion's share of the money because he was an underling in the story. You know, he wasn't in charge. He wasn't making the big money. You know, he's learning how to cook in prison. He's taking classes, and he figures he can get work at a restaurant because that's one of the areas where, you know, having a record doesn't necessarily hurt your skills. So I don't know what he'll end up doing, but yeah, he's not going to be set up for life or anything like that.
So what's your next project?
I'm working on a bunch of projects. I just sold a big movie, I guess, franchise-type picture to 20th Century Fox with Brett Ratner attached to produce. And it's a Da Vinci Code meets, you know, National Treasure type of thriller series about the seven wonders of the world. And then I'm also working on a big new nonfiction book, which is sort of a secret project still. And I have a children's book coming out next summer as well.
Oh, that's very cool.
I think Straight Flush sort of is a mix of 21 and The Social Network, which is why I was kind of turned on to the story. And so I think if people enjoyed those projects, they'll probably like Straight Flush.
Well, I know I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
No problem. Thanks very much.
Bye. And now let's hear a sampling of Straight Flush, the true story of six college friends who dealt their way to a $1 billion online poker empire and how it all came crashing down. Narrated by Sean Pratt.
The man's official title was some sort of liaison with the U.S. State Department, based out of the embassy in San Jose. And up close, even despite the sharp contours of his face, he looked much more like a kindly accountant than a menacing secret operative. But if Brent had learned anything over the past 7 years, it was that there were few things in life that were actually black and white. Most things tended to be a mix of both. "Good morning, Mr. Beckley," the man said as he intercepted Brent a few feet from the entrance to the maze of blue rope. "My name is David Foster. It's nice to meet you." Brent shook the man's hand, trying to think of a response. When none was forthcoming, Foster extended his other hand, offering two documents. The first was instantly familiar, Brent's U.S. passport, the same passport he had turned over to the State Department 3 days earlier. Glancing at the document, Brent felt his mouth go dry. He could see, even without looking closely, that someone had punched 3 holes through the center of the cover. Each dark circle tore at the pit of Brent's stomach. There was something so permanent and real about the sight of that passport. Its mutilation seemed like such a malevolent and unnecessary act. A week earlier, when Brent had first made the decision to turn himself in, the U.S. Embassy had requested a copy of his passport. Brent had been happy to accommodate, offering them the original document so they could copy it themselves. They had promptly confiscated it. Now, he could see the result. It seemed to be just another step in a deceptive game. Brent had already agreed to surrender, and he was in the process of moving his family to the United States. Yet even that wasn't good enough. Foster appeared to read Brent's thoughts and quickly shifted the invalidated passport to the side, revealing the second document in his hand. A thin, similar-looking passport, this one with its cover still intact. Brent took both documents from the man, inspecting the second, smaller booklet, and saw that it was dated for a single day's use. Brent was still free to travel like any other American citizen for the next 24 hours. There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Brent finally shrugged, shoving the two passports into his suit pocket. "Now what?" he asked. Foster's expression turned soft, and he jerked his head toward the blue ropes behind him. "You've got an hour to kill before your flight. You want to get a cup of coffee?" It wasn't quite what Brent had expected, but again, none of this could have been anticipated. He nodded and followed the thin man toward immigration. It was the fastest Brent had ever moved through the Costa Rican airport. Usually, security took forever, especially for young Americans like him. In Brent's experience, some of the native immigration officers seemed to take a special pleasure in hassling young American men traveling to and from the States. Brent assumed it had to do with the massive inequities between the two cultures. To the average Costa Rican, Americans were rich, entitled, and usually obnoxious. From what Brent had seen of the mobs of northerners who kept the local tourist economy alive, usually large groups of men who spent mornings splayed out across the pristine beaches like bleating, bloated, bleached, and beached marine animals, and evenings carousing through the legal brothels that put red-light districts around the world to shame, well, maybe the immigration officers weren't that far off. At the moment, Brent could only marvel as he was towed through immigration and security at a near-Olympic pace. Foster seemed to know everyone who worked at the airport, and even more helpful, the man's Spanish was impeccable. He spoke like a native, though from what Brent could piece together, it appeared that Costa Rica was just one stop on a colorful, government-sponsored road trip that had extended from a military academy in Virginia through a 5-year stint in Iraq to a half dozen embassies across South and Central America.
That was Straight Flush by Ben Mezrich. The Buy Side, a Wall Street trader's tale of spectacular excess by former trader Turney Duff, portrays an after-hours Wall Street culture where drugs and sex are rampant and billions in trading commissions flow to those who dangle the most enticements. The book brilliantly shows the rewards and dizzying temptations of making a living on the street. Growing up in the late 1980s, Duff was your average kid from Kennebunk, Maine. After trying and failing to land a job as a journalist, he secured a trainee position at Morgan Stanley. There he got his first feel for the pecking order of the trading pits. Those on the buy side, the traders who make large bets on whether a stock will rise or fall, are the alphas. Those on the sell side, the brokers who handle their business, are eager to please. When Duff arrived at the Galleon Group, he was finally in a position to trade on his own. He was encouraged to socialize with the sell side and siphon information from his new broker friends. Soon he was just not vacuuming up tips, but being lured into a variety of hedonistic pursuits. At his next positions, Duff climbed to higher heights and plummeted to lower depths. He solidified his rep as one of Wall Street's most powerful healthcare traders, while blazing through the city's nightclubs and inhaling any drug that might fill the void he felt inside. Duff, who narrates, offers up a mesmerizingly immersive journey through Wall Street's first millennial decade.
I'm surrounded by women. The Bar Cité is across the street from our office and is a favorite. I've only recently begun going out after work with my peers. I'm not really all that comfortable with the suit and tie Wall Street hangouts. Give me a pair of jeans and a sawdust floor any day. Cité is primarily a restaurant, and, I must admit, with the curved bar and the intimate space, the place has its merits. The wine glasses are gigantic and the bartenders pour heavy. On a typical night at Cité, pronounced Cité, as in partay, there are 10 to 15 women from our floor at the bar and 5 to 10 men from the trading floor. The spot isn't a secret. Many a six-hour love story has started here. I'm standing at the bar next to Drea and Karen. They both run the syndicate desk on our floor. Drea is short for Andrea. She has piercing blue eyes and a tiny gap between her front teeth, which on her is very sexy. She's almost as naive as I am. She sees the good in everyone. I love hanging out with her. We giggle all the time. Her assistant is Karen, whose eyes are even bluer than Drea's. She has a deep tan and jet black hair. Guys are drawn to her like mosquitoes to a bug zapper. And on this night, her voltage is on high. Just down the crowded bar, a few stools sits David Slane. Everyone on Wall Street knows him. 6 feet tall and muscle-bound, Slane has the body of a professional football player. But his wispy brown hair gives him an almost boyish appearance. Don't be fooled. His hair trigger temper is legendary on the floor. He's the head of the over-the-counter desk. He runs the entire trading operation. When he's angry, which seems like most of the time, he talks to people in grunts. If a trade doesn't go his way, you can practically see the steam coming out of his ears. There's a story often told about Slane that has several versions. Whether it was that he was eating French fries and someone kept bothering him for them, or that someone wouldn't give him any of the fries they were eating, or that he just got mad at the computer terminal really doesn't matter. All of the versions end in the same way, with him ripping the keyboard out of the computer and flinging it across the room. Dave scares me. He scares just about everybody. But when Karen calls him over, I remember Stephanie's stitched pillow suggestion. Slane buzzes over to Karen. When she introduces me, he does a kind of sideways nod in my direction without taking his eyes off her. I've met him before, not that he'd remember. I sit on my stool waiting for my chance to make a comment or add to the conversation. I know I have to do something, or say something. I chug my drink.
That was The Buy Side by Tourney Duff. Most startups fail, but many of those failures are preventable. The Lean Startup, how today's entrepreneurs use continuous innovation to create radically successful businesses, presents a new approach changing the ways companies are built and new products are launched. Eric Ries defines a startup as an organization dedicated to creating something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. This is just as true for one person in a garage as it is for a group of pros in a Fortune 500 boardroom. What they have in common is a mission to penetrate that fog of uncertainty and to discover a successful path to a sustainable business. The lean startup approach fosters companies that are both more capital efficient and that leverage human creativity more effectively. Ries, who narrates, offers entrepreneurs a way to test their vision and to adapt and adjust before it's too late.
After more than 10 years as an entrepreneur, I came to reject that line of thinking. I have learned from both my own successes and failures and those of many others that it's the boring stuff that matters the most. Startup success is not a consequence of good genes or being in the right place at the right time. Startup success can be engineered by following the right process, which means it can be learned, which means it can be taught. Entrepreneurship is a kind of management. No, you didn't read that wrong. We have wildly divergent associations with these two words, entrepreneurship and management. Lately, it seems that one is cool, innovative, and exciting, and the other is dull, serious, and bland. It is time to look past these preconceptions. Let me tell you a second startup story. It's 2004, and a group of founders have just started a new company. Their previous company had failed very publicly. Their credibility is at an all-time low. They have a huge vision to change the way people communicate by using a new technology called avatars. Remember, this was before James Cameron's blockbuster movie. They are following a visionary named Will Harvey, who paints a compelling picture. People connecting with their friends, hanging out online, using avatars to give them a combination of intimate connection and safe anonymity. Even better, instead of having to build all the clothing, furniture, and accessories these avatars would need to accessorize their digital lives, the customers would be enlisted to build those things and sell them to one another. The engineering challenge before them is immense. Creating virtual worlds, user-generated content, an online commerce engine, micropayments, and, last but not least, the three-dimensional avatar technology that can run on anyone's PC. I'm in this second story, too. I'm a co-founder and chief technology officer of this company, which is called ImView. At this point in our careers, my co-founders and I are determined to make new mistakes. We do everything wrong. Instead of spending years perfecting our technology, we build a minimum viable product, an early product that is terrible, full of bugs and crash your computer, yes, really, stability problems. Then we ship it to customers way before it's ready, and we charge money for it. After securing initial customers, we change the product constantly, much too fast by traditional standards, shipping new versions of our product dozens of times every single day. We really did have customers in those early days, true visionary early adopters, and we often talked to them and asked for their feedback. But we emphatically did not do what they said. We viewed their input as only one source of information about our product and overall vision. In fact, we were much more likely to run experiments on our customers than we were to cater to their whims. Traditional business thinking says that this approach shouldn't work, but it does. And you don't have to take my word for it. As you'll see throughout this book, the approach we pioneered at ImView has become the basis for a new movement of entrepreneurs around the world. It builds on many previous management and product development ideas, including lean manufacturing, design thinking, customer development, and agile development. It represents a new approach to creating continuous innovation. It's called the Lean Startup.
That was a sample of The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. Ilana Edelstein was born in South Africa, where she lived until her late 20s. After emigrating to the U.S., she worked her way through the ranks of personal assistant, office manager, commercial sales, financial advisor, and ultimately established herself as a respected businesswoman. None of this prepared her for meeting the love of her life, Martin Crowley, co-founder of St. Martin Spirits. It was an instant magical union, shortly followed by the birth of Patron Tequila. Ilana was involved in every aspect of the business, from the brand's iconic bottle to designing the sexy outfits the famous Patron girls wore at industry parties. After their years together ended, Ilana was left destitute. She hit the ground running, though, and built IE Financial Services, providing financial and retirement services to teachers and school employees across Central and Southern California. Her new book, The Patron Way, is the story of how Patron became the world's top-selling ultra-premium tequila. It's a tale set against the backdrop of love, sex, celebrity, dizzying success, and ultimately betrayal. Welcome, Alana, and thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. In 1989, your partner Martin was in Mexico, but he wasn't looking for a tequila. Share the story of how he found the tequila that would become Patron.
Well, he was trying to break the monotony of his day. He was traveling through what happened to be the tequila region, sourcing products for his then company, Architectural Products. And he told his driver to stop at each tequila factory that they passed so that he could taste the tequila just to break up the monotony. And that's when he came across this tequila that tasted like nothing he had ever tasted before and stopped him in his tracks, really, figuratively and literally speaking. And that is what came home and became Patron.
Mm. Martin and you worked with John Paul DeJoria, the owner of Paul Mitchell Hair Products. What was his role?
His role was a partner in the Architectural Products company. Then when Martin brought back the tequila and we designed the bottle and we just had fun with it and got the dead fly out of the original bottle, we went to John Paul's for dinner and took it with us. And that's where officially Patron Tequilas began, because John Paul said, go back to Mexico, get 10,000 cases. If we can't sell it, worst case, we'll have the best tequila in the world for ourselves and our friends. And that's really officially where the company was launched, at that dinner party.
And you were involved with almost every aspect of bringing the company to be such a huge success.
Yes, I was. Not even consciously, you know, picking a department. We both just did what was necessary, whatever needed to be done, and we had no idea what was supposed to be done. None of us had any idea about the liquor industry, so we just did what we thought needed to be done, and we were creative people and came up with marketing plans that we thought is how they would probably do it, which, of course, is not how they did it. But we got noticed that way and really turned conventional wisdom on its head inadvertently.
You know, I loved your description of your big launch in Las Vegas. And actually, the first Patron girl was a prostitute?
Yes.
Tell us that story.
Well, that was a last resort, please note. We only found out 2 days before that we were invited. Someone had canceled the booth and they had offered it to us. And we just assumed that the liquor industry would be like the auto industry conventions, that there would be girls draped all over the place. So I had customized one of my dresses into kind of a Patron T-shirt and went to Vegas to look for some girls to work for the next day. We had an agency, and they took us to all the different the showgirls, and they were gorgeous, but the dress was this tight spandex, and it cut right down to your belly, and if you didn't have boobs, it would completely flatten them. Anyway, it looked like little boys in these dresses. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and the next day was the show, and we didn't have our girls. So Martin and I were on the same page. We just picked up the Yellow Pages and called Desert Foxes and started interviewing prostitutes, and we found our girl, and she was absolutely fabulous. She really was.
In the early days, Patron had a lot of exposure in the movies. Share some of those stories.
We did, and that was really, I would have to call it luck, if there is such a thing. John Paul, that's the circle he moved in, and he never went anywhere without a Patron bottle in his hand. So we did. We got a lot of friends in the celebrity circles that insisted on Patron, be it in their movies, be it in their contracts backstage, like Bruce Springsteen, that was part of his contract, and the late Jerry Garcia. Those were the kind of things those kind of things you can't really buy. You can buy your brand in a movie, but we never paid a dime for that. Everything that we got in those early years was completely out of friendship, really. Clint Eastwood, for instance, in The Line of Fire, Patrone Bottle had an up-close shot for probably a minute while he was negotiating a serious scene in the movie where he was negotiating with a terrorist. Patrone had its moment that would have usually cost millions of dollars, and we didn't pay a dime. All of that, you know, I don't like calling it luck. I think that's what John Paul brought to the table.
Well, of course, there was a partnership with Seagram's, which went very sour. What advice would you give to, you know, aspiring business people who partner with these mega corporations?
Well, I mean, the first obvious thing would be, you know, be adequately represented, because at the end of the day, it comes down to whoever has, you know, the sharpest attorneys, because they cut the deals. Martin was a brilliant negotiator, and still, he ended up in a contract where, you know, we ended up in this horrific lawsuit. In our case, you know, he knew that he needed a bailout clause, and he knew that he had to pin them down to buying minimums. What he didn't know is that they shouldn't have to buy minimums, they should have to sell minimums, which makes a big difference, because in their case, they bought it and just kept it on the shelf for 5 years because they could buy into the company at that point. And the formula would be based on what the bottom line was. So they were holding the bottom. They could afford to hold the bottom line down low so they could buy in at that point. Well, Martin saw this happening at 3 years where the bailout clause was, so he bailed. Those are the kind of examples that I can only say, you know, can you protect yourself against them? No. I think it's all part of a learning curve. You can try and get the best attorneys possible. There's no guarantees, you know. If you're going into a business that you don't know the ins and outs of, you know you're going to run into some of these kind of things. So you have to have some sort of backup, be it a deep pocket, a partner that can get you through it financially. Those are the only, there's no protection. There is no protection against the unknown.
And then, sadly, your 13-year affair with Martin ended very sourly, too, but yet you were able to, you know, pick yourself back up and start on a whole new career path. Talk about that.
Yes, I was. Well, you don't really have a choice, you know. You can either just lay at the bottom of this very dark pit, or you pick yourself up and you have to move forward. And thank goodness I had what I had. My old career where I had kept my license current, so I could go back to work. I am also being approached by other liquor companies wanting me as brand ambassadors and consultants, so I'm busy negotiating on those.
Well, I want to tell readers that at the end of your book, you actually have a business advice segment, which I really enjoyed. I especially liked when you said, know the difference between consistency and clinging to old ways.
Yes. Don't let conventional wisdom constrain you. You know, we are our own best customers and our own best brand ambassadors. So, you know, think about how you would react to something, because 10 to 1, that's what the public will do. You know, don't treat your customers like they are idiots, because they aren't. They know, you know, if you change your consistency of your brand, they will know it.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. The book was fascinating, and you tell it very, very intimately. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Often downplayed in the excitement of starting up a new business is one of the most important decisions entrepreneurs will face. Should they go it alone or bring in co-founders, hires, and investors? More than financial rewards are at stake. Friendships and relationships can suffer. Bad decisions at the inception of a promising venture lay the foundation for its eventual ruin. The Founder's Dilemma by Noam Wasserman is the first book to examine the early decisions by entrepreneurs that can make or break a startup. Drawing on a decade of research, Wasserman reveals common pitfalls founders face and how to avoid them. The Founders' Dilemmas draws on inside stories of founders like Evan Williams of Twitter and Tim Westergren of Pandora. Mark Mosley narrates the book that offers solutions.
It's unfortunate, but true. If entrepreneurship is a battle, most casualties stem from friendly fire or self-inflicted wounds. Some four decades ago, sociologist Arthur Stinchcomb attributed much of the liability of newness, the particularly high failure rate of new organizations, to problems within a startup's founding team. More recently, venture capitalists in one survey attributed 65% of failures within their portfolio companies to problems within the startup's management team. Another study asked investors to identify problems they thought might occur within their portfolio companies. A full 61% of such problems involved issues within the team. Researchers have extensively studied the failure rates highlighted by Stinchcomb. Unfortunately, they have focused almost entirely on external causes rather than on the more numerous internal problems Stinchcomb identified. We know amazingly little about the chief perils that beset the entrepreneurial activity we so often acclaim as the very heart and soul of the economy. As researcher Amar Baid put it, entrepreneurs who start and build new businesses are more celebrated than studied. This audiobook scrutinizes those all-important people problems that bedevil all founders, even solo founders, and their startups. These problems often follow predictably from common dilemmas faced by any startup as it grows and evolves, what I call founding dilemmas. One such dilemma recurs throughout the stages of company development: the need to negotiate a trade-off between wealth and control, between building financial value and maintaining a grip on the steering wheel. Adding further complexity, founders' early choices can have delayed and unexpected but significant effects, sometimes because natural inclinations such as passion, optimism, and conflict avoidance lead to short-sighted decisions. This audiobook delves into the challenges faced or created by each of the main groups of players involved in a typical startup, beginning with the core founder and moving on to his or her co-founders, early hires, and investors. I've spent over a decade working with hundreds of founders and future founders, and I've collected and analyzed data on nearly 10,000 founders in the technology and life sciences industries. This audiobook will draw on my unique data set, and we will also follow actual founders as they launch new companies and struggle with dilemmas identified in my research. Most centrally, we explore the experience of Evan Williams, a young entrepreneur who moved from rural Nebraska to the San Francisco area in the mid-1990s, hoping to catch the wave of the internet boom after working on a failed startup back home. A self-taught web designer and programmer, Evan recognized the potential of internet applications, particularly in the exploding area of self-publishing, and created Blogger, one of the first and most popular blogging tools. Later, Evan developed an early podcasting idea, Odeo, which he believed would enable non-technical people to produce, publish, and share audio content, much as Blogger had done for millions of ordinary people with the written word. In both startups, and then later when he went on to found and lead Twitter before leaving to work on yet another startup, Evan faced key dilemmas, difficult decisions at important forks in the road of his entrepreneurial journey.
That was a sample of The Founder's Dilemmas by Noam Wasserman. Readers, and you were worried today's show would be a little dry. Nonsense. My goal and my passion is to bring you titles that present new ideas to get you thinking and to keep you entertained. It's a big literary world out there. Okay, it might be true that business books are not your usual bill of fare. Make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for new titles in your favorite genres. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.